opportunity. So the presenters this evening, moving from the right to left, Rabbi Dr. Jerry Loeb is a household name here in Chicago because of his great wisdom and insight, both from a Torah and psychological standpoint, as a prestigious clinician, but also as a Rebbe and a Machanech and a mentor to many parents and children, to families and individuals. Rabbi Zev Reichman is the rabbi of the East Hill Synagogue in Englewood, New Jersey. He's also the head of the Mechina program, the Jewish Studies program at Yeshiva University. And he is the author of Flames of Faith, a book on Hasidus. It's in English. I'm not going to take a show of hands how many people in my shir have heard me quote that book and bring that book. But you know who you are. We've quoted it many times, so it's a highly recommended read for those who enjoy Hasidus like I do. And Rabbi Steve Berg is of international renown as the director, the international director of NCSY. He's also very involved in the running of the entire Orthodox Union. He got his start on the West Coast, where he became famous for founding the Jewish Student Union, and then he came to Teaneck, where he's used that as the headquarters of essentially inspiring and enlightening Jews, teens, adults. Everybody would like to be like teens, all of us. These three individuals are all my Rabbeim, and I'm grateful and so appreciative that they took the time to come out. Our facilitator this evening is David Strulowitz, who himself pursues a spirituality as an avocation and something that he feels passionate about and something that's close to his heart and our hearts, and he has great wisdom to share, and he will be our facilitator this evening. At the conclusion, in about 25 minutes, we will daven Maariv right here in the main sanctuary. Thank you all. B'chavod.
First of all, thank you very much for hosting us. We had a very long day. Baruch Hashem, we finally got here. I just want to start just a couple words because I found this topic to me to be fascinating. I said in our session before that I think this is the single most issue facing the Orthodox Jewish community today is the struggle with spirituality. But I'm going to tell you a struggle of my own, which took place about a year and a half ago. In northern Jersey, the schools basically decided that many of the day schools are struggling with tuition. And there was a decision that if for any kids that were going to camp or summer programs, that they were not going to be eligible for scholarships. And there was a whole back and forth. I wrote an op-ed in Jewish Week that got me in a lot of trouble, basically saying how I thought that was a bad idea. But I started thinking about it afterwards. Why was I so defensive of camps and summer programs, this summer experience? What was going on there, right, that I felt was so important to the education of a teen? And I have to tell you what I did. I basically set up my summer, last summer, to go 9 Shabbatot in a row to go to camps, to Morashah, Masorah, Moshavah. I went to a camp in Austria that NCSY runs, Israel. I mean, literally, I set up 9 Shabbatot in a row to kind of discover what the answer was. And I'll tell you, it was really amazing because the first Shabbat, the first Friday night, I figured it out. But then I was stuck for another 8 Shabbatot running around. But I'll tell you what I saw in Morashah. That was my first Shabbos. I walk into the dining room, right, Friday night, sit down. Now, this is the first Shabbos. The kids just got there. And within 30 seconds, they're all on their benches, right? I don't know, they're screaming Baruch HaGever, Wah Wah Ooh, whatever they're doing, right? They're all like, and they're on their benches for like an hour straight, right? And then they go off and do whatever they do afterwards. And I'm thinking to myself, there is not a person, child, teen, adolescent in this room that last week would have been caught dead doing any of this stuff back at home. What changed in the course of a week? And that's when I realized that the greatness of youth groups, camps, summer programs, all these experiences is that there is a cocoon, right? There's like a dome that descends on these places where cynicism and sarcasm are not allowed inside. Why were they on their benches? Because everyone else was, and they knew no one was going to laugh at them. And I think I realized at that point that the opposite of spirituality is not being spiritual. The opposite of spirituality is cynicism and sarcasm, because that's what kills it. And as Orthodox Jews, so many times, you know, whether you're a Shabbos day or other things, there's so much cynicism and sarcasm out there that in order for us to be spiritual, we need to push that to the side to make that happen.
Thank you, Scott. So, it's been a great night so far. And I want to thank everybody for coming in. I especially want to thank Rabbi Brandon. He made it sound like it was me, but the truth is he approached me about this whole evening, and I want to thank him, and I want to recognize that, and I really do appreciate the effort that you made. And I don't think I made it too easy to be on you to begin with, because I definitely was challenging you. And part of the reason why I was challenging him about the whole idea of doing some programming is because I find this to be a huge challenge to take on, or just to talk about something that I feel, in my personal life, I feel very challenged by. There's a joke that goes something like, what's the definition of insanity? It's doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And in my life, I know I'd gotten to the point where, you know, I wasn't seeing a different result. I really want to know why. We heard tonight a great discussion by Rabbi Livingston about the role of light, why we light candles on Shabbat. And Rabbi Rachman, I didn't get to hear everybody, spoke about the role of Chassidut and other things, other insights into the things that we do and the importance of them. But for me, it's very practical. I want to know why it's a glass of wine that I initiate Shabbat at the Shabbat table. I want to know why I'm going to shake the lulav in a couple of weeks. I want to know why I was putting my sukkah up in part today. I want to know why. I just don't want to mindlessly go through those things. And part of the discussion that started off with when we came across the Klal Perspectives Journal, I'm going to read you a quote from that, which is in the materials that we handed out, but this one really hit home for me because I, up until that point, I really thought I was alone. The lack of connection, and this is, if you want to email me or find me, I'll find you, or I'm sure the rabbi will also.
On the back of the schedules that you got was an online journal called Klal Perspectives that had an entire issue dedicated to this issue of spirituality. So you have the source there, you click on the link, there are about a dozen different responses.
The quote that I want to read you, which I bolded in my material, is the lack of connection, and this is with respect to people who really aren't feeling exactly what Rabbi Berg said, that this is the greatest challenge, and it was a recognition of that. The lack of connection is reflected most dramatically in the growing numbers of so-called adults at risk, i.e., those who at some point in adulthood realize they do not know why they have been performing mitzvot in all their lives or why they should continue to do so. And that's the challenge, and I don't expect that we're really going to answer that tonight. But I certainly want, as with all things, we need to know what the problem is, otherwise we never stand a chance of moving in the right direction. And we need to acknowledge it. And I think step one tonight is just acknowledgement. But beyond that, anything that we can do to assist us, especially this time of year, to see a different outcome. We can't continue to do the same things we have and expect there to be a different outcome in this year. And so to the degree that we can open our minds up in any way possible, and for each one of us, it's very individualistic. It's all up to us because we all have different experiences. But the idea that we have to look at life in a different way and take actions in a different way if we want a different outcome. That's what got us here. Or at least what got me here. So then I was starting to think about like panel. Boy, that's quite a challenge. So what I did was, what do I know? I went, just walked up to my library. It was the first things that jumped out at me. So what I want to do is share with you a couple quotes from texts I know that you're familiar with, and perhaps you can give us some sense for the relevance that it has really right here, right now. The first that I thought I would share with you is a quote from the Piasetzna, the Eish Kodesh, who was a Holocaust-era Polish Rav and Kabbalist. And this is from his book, B'nai Machshava Tova. And the quote goes as follows: "And not only at times of prayer and other service should we feel close to God and take pleasure from the radiance of his glory, may he be blessed. Rather, our thoughts should always be so clear, strong, and connected to his holiness that it can overwhelm our senses. Then our senses will be unable to confuse our thoughts and turn them astray and tell us that this world you see is everything, and this physicality that you sense is everything. And even more, our senses will be subjugated to the thought of our heart." So what he's saying, and I'm going to paraphrase, but I think you get the point, is that he's talking about, in his very descriptive style, a consciousness where we're not so absorbed by physicality, that we can actually see that there is a world beyond, that there is a creator, that there is some greater power, that there is some greater order of things. But of course, that's the challenge that we squarely find ourselves in. And so what I wanted to put the question to you guys, whoever wants to actually answer first, is in the work that you do, and you're all working in slightly different circles, what is it that you've seen people do that's been successful on a very practical day-to-day level?
Well, I mean, I'll jump in. Obviously, to agree with what Rabbi Berg said and what David mentioned, obviously, we can't see with our eyes that which is spiritual, that which isn't physical. And the great challenge, which is what the Pia Setzner was referring to, is that so often we think that what's real, and we see this even in our language, the real world, supposedly, is the world that's materialistic, professional, university education, whereas spirituality or God's directives, that becomes something vague, something spiritual, not necessarily real. And the Pia Setzner Rebbe's point was that it's not the case. The truth is that the spiritual realm is much more real than the physical realm. And I think that for us to both inspire ourselves and inspire our children to be aware of the spiritual core that's within each of us, of the spiritual drive within each of us, we need to find opportunities and take advantage of opportunities that present themselves to bring this awareness, this consciousness, this sense of being in the presence of God to home. So, for example, Rav Volpe of blessed memory said that to teach children about prayer, it shouldn't be taught in a classroom where the kids open a sitter and they translate the words of the sitter. Rather, when a father is walking with his son at night, coming back from a shul on a Friday night and the sun is setting and the crickets are chirping and there's a sense of, wow, what a beautiful world. To turn to the sun and say, this is what we mean when we say that God is Ma'ariv Aravim, Umavir Yom, Umevi Laila. He moves away the day and he brings in the night. Quiet, listen to the sounds of night. Enter. In other words, what is tefillah? Tefillah is not just how to translate each word or how to read the words correctly, but the essence of tefillah is to talk to the Almighty. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik very famously taught that the core of kavana and tefillah is to have the sense of standing before God, to cultivate that sense of being in front of the Almighty. Rav Yecheskel Levenstein, the Mashgiach of the Panovich Yeshiva, he used to give his children money if they could tell him a story of where they saw the hand of God that day in their life. You sit down at the table and say, let's hear a Hashgacha Pratis story. Something that happened to you today that you saw the Almighty was taking care of you. And if they had a good story, they would get an allowance. They'd get money for it to open the eyes to be aware of these experiences. We do it in our house. Sometimes we sit down at the table, we say, what story do you have of Hashgacha Pratis today, of something great that happened to you? We had a great degree of Hashgacha Pratis today. Flight was delayed, flight was canceled, and then the other flight, thankfully, came in early. So we came, just at the right time. We would tell our kids, what story do you have today of Hashgacha Pratis, of God's hand? Where do you see the non-physical reality to develop a sense of the reality of those experiences? In addition to cynicism, but another great challenge to spirituality in our communities is that life is really, really good and it's really, really comfortable. As someone who lives in Englewood, which is probably in the top 0.5% of America in terms of income levels, life is unbelievably comfortable. People have multiple cars. Kids at age 17 are driving BMWs. Everything is really great. I mean, think back to 100 years ago in London, 20% of the children in London didn't get past the age of 5. 100 years ago, there was a sense of life isn't so great. Life is tenuous. There's a lot to really call out to God about. But nowadays, thankfully, life is extraordinarily comfortable. And things are very easy. And because things are so comfortable and so easy and so unbelievably blessed, it's hard to have a sense of existential angst, of absolute insecurity and complete dependence on the Almighty. And that adds to the challenge. But just because there's more of a challenge doesn't mean that there's less of an opportunity. The greater the challenge, the greater the achievement. And especially we who live in a world which is so comfortable and so easy, to really have a true spiritual achievement means much more for someone who it's harder for them to really feel an attachment with the Almighty because life is so comfortable. And I think that, you know, a message that we can encourage within our homes and within our schools and within our families is the idea that to sacrifice is actually unbelievably inspiring. It's unbelievably touching when we experience Mesiras Nefesh. Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that the definition of sanctity is always identified with sacrifice. The Beis HaMikdash was the place of offering karbanos. And we're all touched by stories of sacrifice. When we think of the story of Roi Klein, Zchuto Yagen Aleinu, a major with 2 children at home, jumping on a grenade, saying Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad to save the 2 soldiers next to him. That touches everyone. Why does it touch everyone? Because there is sacrifice there. And to encourage our children that whenever they have a chance to sacrifice some ease, to invite other kids that maybe aren't from the cool crowd, make sure that they're invited for the bar mitzvahs, make sure they have play dates, to reach out to the kids that aren't always welcomed, to sacrifice comfort for the sake of going to shul, for the sake of going to minyan. When we inculcate a message that sacrifice is unbelievably special, that's when we experience the Almighty. That's when we have a spiritual experience. I think that's one of the messages that we need to tell our children and tell our friends and ourselves, because we have a lot of comfort. And whenever we sacrifice some of that comfort, it's one of the ways in which we attach to something which is beyond just that which we see, just that which we experience.
Rabbi Dr. Loeb, I wanted to ask you a question. I'm moving in a slightly different direction. One of the articles actually is by another rabbi doctor, David Fox. I don't know if you had a chance to take a look at it. But like yourself, I don't know if you're a clinical psychologist, but I think you are. Yeah. So very similar. But I want to read you a quote, and I'm hoping you can give me a little insight into this. He talks about, among those who have run to Torah in search of existential meaning and fulfillment of a sense, you know, to fill a void, I'm paraphrasing, a familiar complaint is strict practice of Judaism is dominated by halachic emphasis. I think we all know that. Where there is a priority, the priority is cognitive focus, which seldom promotes sensory, intuitive, and affective experiences. Now, my point is this. We are all familiar with halacha pretty much in this community. But I would expect in the work that you do that you come across people who are in a situation where they aren't finding such meaning in the things that they do. And so there's a unique challenge, clearly, that we find as a community in a halachic, you know, emphasis and meaning. And can you shed any light on some perhaps tools or insights into that?
So a few years ago, I met a 40-year-old man who spent really 20 years learning in Kollel. And he said to me, I've never really had a real davening in my whole life. And he was spending 10, 12 hours a day studying Torah, learning Gemara, learning Halacha. He was brilliant. halachic authority in his, at least in his group, very well versed, could quote chapter and verse, but it never touched him emotionally. I said, "You're exaggerating," and he said, "No. Davening never really meant anything to me." And I said, "Is Hashem real to you?" And he stopped for a second. He said, "You know, I never even thought of that question." He never had an emotional moment. I said, "What about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur?" He said, "No." No. So, yeah. That is extreme, I think. However, it's not as extreme as we would like to hope. So there has to be an emotional component. If all of this is cognitive or intellectual, then it could be a PhD in English literature. To make Torah be an attachment, I have to be aware of the attachment. To study Torah is to connect with the intimate, with the infinite, and in an intimate way. When one of my children was 6 or 7 years old, he was helping for Shabbos on a Friday afternoon. He was in a good mood, and all was well with the world. He had a lot of candy, and school was over for the week, and he just wanted to help. So he said, "I want to set the table." 6 years old, or so, and you know, he's setting the table and he's putting out the plates, and I'm hoping he's not going to drop any. And he's going around, and you know, I noticed that he put out more plates than were necessary. And I said, "Yaakov, I'm thinking like there's something off with him math wise. You know, he's like not getting it." So I said, "Who's coming? Who's going to be home for Shabbos?" So he said, you know, two of his brothers, and he mentioned one, you know, another guest, and then he said, "You know, you and mommy and me." And I said, "Okay, so let's go around the table." And you know, and I pointed out, and I pointed out there was an extra place there, and he said, "Well, Hashem's coming." So you know, the women in the audience are saying, "Aw." You know, and the men are thinking, "Okay, move on." but it struck me, and I spoke to Ayala, my wife, and I said, "You know, Hashem's really real to him. Let's not blow this." What I mean by that is that when we're children, of course it's real. When mommy does the Shema with me, it's real. There's an emotional component. There has to be an emotional component. If my lave's not involved, then it's not going to be real. The real parts of my life are connected to the things that move me. I need to be moved. When I was in fifth grade, I had a very abusive teacher. Some of you have heard me say this before. A very abusive teacher. I grew up in Brooklyn. I'm not going to mention the name of the school. A very abusive, not physically, not sexually, but verbally. So he had lots of names. And I annoyed him in some way. And I came in for a lot of his abuse. So I remember that year, the fifth grade, and I remember that year, probably every night, because my parents had said to me that after you say the Shema, they would say the Shema with me. I was, you know, fifth grade is 9, 10 years old. After you say the Shema, you could, you know, close your eyes and talk to Hashem in English about anything you want. So I spent that whole year praying to God that he would kill my teacher. That's what it did. I always look back and I'm thinking, thank God that that teacher didn't die that year. Because it totally would have messed with my head. I'd think, whoa, God is my hitman. You know, I got power. Okay, so when I look back to that grade, when I look back to that time in my life, that fifth grade, it took me a very long time, over 40 years, to forgive that teacher. It took me 40 years to get to a place of letting it go. Okay. I never had a problem with God. And not only that, I don't even have a problem with the whole incident, because from that day on, God was real to me. Hashem, I grew up from, but Hashem wasn't real till fifth grade. Because I went to him, I cried to him. Hashem was real. We have to make it real. You know, I studied in Kollel too, but to me, I don't know. I had good teachers and I had good parents about this. You know, my father used to cry by davening sometimes. I knew Hashem was real because especially in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, but he used to cry. My mother would cry when she lit Shabbos candles. I knew this was real. You know, the reality is for our children to see our parents being emotional. And I said this story over once, not that long ago. One of my children said to me, Hashem is real to me, he said to me, because for years I stood next to you, Dad, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and heard you cry. You know, there's a Mesorah, we pass down the reality of God if we are emotional in connection to Him. Is the relationship a real one or not? Is it real? Okay, I'll just say one last thing, you know, because on this topic, the intellectual stuff can get in the way, but there's a way to do the intellectual stuff, and yet it has this moving thing. Somewhere, I got this chinuch, I don't know where, maybe it started in that fifth grade, that I had this feeling that when I figured out a Rashi, or I figured out a hard piece of Talmud, or I figured out a hard discussion in the Tosfos, and it made sense to me, I was ecstatic, and not only that, at some deep level, I felt that Hashem was proud of me. It was real. And this is the part that leads to this hard part. Because I think, as a psychologist, I think the reason why I was able to make that bridge of feeling like Hashem was proud of me, that's a very child-parent relationship feeling. I don't know how else to say that. That's a paternal, maternal kind of relationship. So here's the deal. And I say this to parents all the time. Whenever I talk about parenting classes and I'm talking to spiritual people, I'll say, you need to create the kind of relationship with your children that they trust you. Because if you trust your parents, your parents don't need to be perfect, but if you trust your parents, it's much easier to trust Hashem. And trust is the name of the game, because that's the emotional piece. Because life, even though it is so much better than it was 100 years ago, but the other parts of life that are painful are still just as painful. Life is filled with pain. The ability to be able to maintain my relationship with God in the face of the incredible pain that I might be going through has to be related to, I trust you. I know that you love me. I know that you wouldn't do this if it wasn't necessary. I need to be able to say that. That's Shar Bitachon in Chovos Avavos. That's what he teaches us. Shar Bitachon is to be able to say, I can trust you, Hashem, even though I'm in so much pain now. It's easier to do that if you trusted your parents. If you didn't trust your parents, it becomes hard. It's not impossible. Hashem makes himself available to everybody. But it's just easier. We make life easier for our children if they knew that no matter what, I can trust my parents. They're not going to betray me. They're not going to abuse me. That if they blow it sometimes, they'll say they're sorry. They'll give me hugs. They'll love me even if I'm imperfect, even if I don't meet their expectations, even if I'm not an A student, even if I'm not a size 4. They're going to love me no matter what. We need spirituality comes from like feeling the sense of Hashem loves me and he's proud of me. Even though I'm full of sin. Even on Yom Kippur, even on Rosh Hashanah, not even, especially on Rosh Hashanah and on Yom Kippur, he loves me.
Thank you. We got to cut things short. Anything you'd like to add?
On that note, yeah.
You've got about a minute.
Okay, no problem. Very, very quickly, because you mentioned the Eish Kodesh. I'll tell you just a very, very, very quick Dvar Torah that I said last week in Germany, actually, at a Chag HaSmicha in front of the German foreign minister, and every speech was about Bris Milah. So I won't mention that part here. But you talk about Eish Kodesh. Over 70 years ago, the Eish Kodesh asked the following question, which is that when Moshe and God are talking by the burning bush, and God is trying to convince Moshe to go back to Egypt and save the Jews, and Moshe says, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it, back and forth. All of a sudden, Moshe says, well, if I go back, which name should I use? And Hashem says, oh, use Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh. What'll be is what'll be, right? And Moshe says, okay, great, and they go on their conversation. And what's clear is the two of them understand it, but what's also clear is none of us really understand what that name means. And the Eish Kodesh, who you quoted, who is one of the great, great thinkers, over 70 years ago, said this in the Warsaw Ghetto to the Jews there. He said that there are two ways in which we look at our life. The first way is in the present. I'm sitting here in the shul. I'm listening to brilliant Divrei Torah by the two gentlemen over here, right? And the other way we look at our lives is the past. This is where I came from, this, you know, etc. He says there's a third way to look at your life. He said that's in the future. So he said Hashem was saying to Moshe, Moshe, you need to know, I understand right now, right? You're sitting here, you're a shepherd, you're working for your father-in-law. Moshe, you have to understand who you could be, how great you can be, right? And when you go back to Klal Yisrael, they're sitting, they're slaves now, they can't see themselves as being anything else. They have to know who they can be. And when you deliver that message, and that is the message of spirituality, it's not who we are right now. Right now, it may not be so connected. We need to teach our kids, we need to teach everyone who you can be. That's exactly what these gentlemen were talking about drilling how to come to love Hashem, how to create, how to build. And that's what I think the Eish Kodesh was leaving us with.
I just want to leave you with one thought. Thank you very much. And that is something I came across last week. You know, we, this time of year, we're always dipping things in honey. Get the apple in the honey. We're spreading honey on our challahs. Why honey? So the answer that I typically hear is because we want a sweet new year. But if the answer were just that, couldn't we just use sugar or maybe maple syrup? Why are we using actually the byproduct of the bee? Why are we using a byproduct of any animal? When do we ever use a byproduct of an animal? Why honey? So the insight that I saw, and I think that this is really, it's the essence of the honey. It's also the essence of this evening, and it's probably the essence of all the work we need to do. The bees work hard. All that hard work transforms into honey. And our job, especially this time of year, is to do the work that we need to do to transform ourselves into not who we are now, but who we need to be. And also not be satisfied with where we're at. There are things that we're not happy with, when there's a life that we find unfulfilling, or things that we find unmeaningful, we need to do the work. That's the way the system was set up. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you.